Happy 4th of July from Miki Couture. Celebrate Independence Day with the coziest, most luxurious blankets ever. Whether you're watching fireworks, having a picnic, or just relaxing at home, our blankets will keep you snug and stylish. Join us in making this holiday unforgettable with the comfort of Miki Couture. Wrap yourself in the best blankets ever and enjoy the warmth of freedom and comfort. Visit us at www.mikicouture.com or your nearest store today. Happy 4th of July from all of us at Miki Couture.
Mr. President, I'm not saying we wouldn't get our hair mussed, but I do say no more than 10 to 20 million killed, tops, depending on the breaks.
Mandrake, have you never wondered why I drink only distilled water or rainwater and only pure grain alcohol?
Well, it did occur to me, Jack, yes.
Have you ever heard of a thing called fluoridation, fluoridation of water?
Yes, I have heard of that, Jack, yes. Yes.
Well, do you know what it is?
No. I don't know what it is now.
Do you realize that fluoridation is the most monstrously conceived and dangerous communist plot we have ever had to face?
I'd love to come. But, what's happened, you see? The string in my leg's gone.
The what?
And the string. I never told you, but you see, got a gammy leg. Oh, dear. Gone, shot off.
Mandrake, come over here. The redcoats are coming.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Monsieur! It's in war!
You know, some places are like people. Some shine and some don't.
You set them up and I'll knock them back, Lloyd. One by one.
I was cured, all right.
Welcome, everybody, to AM Bide. Welcome to the desert of the real and happy heresies. We are writing our own gospel, and we are living our own myth. We are running with those searching for the truth and avoiding those who have found it. My name is Miguel Connor. Welcome you with arms wide open. For some reason, I keep quoting Creed out of all bands. It's in my head. But I am your Pompidus of Gnosis. And very excited to have you on this Tuesday for a very special show and a book that I really enjoyed, a book I couldn't put down. And it opened a lot of new vistas on a very popular, legendary, and often controversial figure, and that is Stanley Kubrick. And with us, I can't think of anybody better to do this than my friend Steven Snyder, who will be discussing, yes, his new book, The Minotaur, A Kubrick Odyssey. Steven, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, sir, and it's great to be back here. Thank you very much for having me tonight.
Always enjoy hosting you, regardless of where it is, whether it's Memphis, Astronosis, virtual, anywhere. It's always a lot of fun hanging with you. And with us, too, we've got Graham. Graham, how are you doing?
Doing very well this evening. Looking forward to hearing about the more of the hidden side of Kubrick.
More? There's a lot. And I think what I like about Steven's book is that he dispels a lot of some of these conspiracies, and he brings a lot of humanity into Kubrick, which makes it almost kind of a touching book, I would say, a personal book. I mean, Steven, he is your favorite director, right, as you say in your book?
Yeah, no, I definitely feel like a big part of why I do what I do today is because of Kubrick. He was the first artist I feel like I really had a personal connection with. I mean, I'm almost embarrassed to say this, but I actually did die on the day Stanley, or I did cry on the day that Stanley Kubrick died in 1999. So It's definitely something that's been with me for a while. And your part of me did die too when he
of course. Something new came out. Do you have a favorite movie of his?
I would say Dr. Strangelove and Eyes Wide Shut would have been my longtime favorites, though in more recent years, I've really started to warm up to Barry Lyndon as well.
Mm. Yeah, I definitely need to rewatch that one. It kind of gets overlooked. And It's interesting too. I would have to say Dr. Strangelove for me. And yes, I have to bring it up. That was Elvis's favorite Kubrick movie. In fact, that was one of his favorite movies all the time. He would walk around and annoy people saying, "Gentlemen, you can't fight here. This is the war room." And yeah, Elvis was a big Peter Sellers fan. I mean, I've always been huge.
He screened it in Graceland a couple of times, didn't he, Rex?
Yeah. He would rent out the whole theater in the middle of the night and just sit there with Priscilla and his gang. And sometimes fans would be outside. Sometimes he would bring them in and say, "Look, you know, just be quiet, sit. I'm paying for everything." And I think he watched, Dr. Strangelove, and he kept telling the guy, "Please, you know, play it again. I want to see the scene." But then he was able to get the film or whatever you call it. And he did screen it at Graceland as well.
Fantastic. It's a kind of a nice little synchronistic touch there, since you and I obviously went to Graceland back in November, late October, somewhere thereabouts, which I think was right around the time I was getting ready to start working on this book. So,
no, really? Yeah. I can't wait to get back, and this time to go to Tupelo. So, so much there. But you'd already done, I mean, this book, you didn't start it from scratch, because I've seen you talk about it, do presentations in other places. This was basically just putting together your years of research, or what was the process, Stephen?
Well, like I said, it definitely was something that I've been kind of working on for years. I guess the genesis went back to a series of articles I did on my blog, Vizup, on the film Dr. Strangelove. I think all the way back, Lyle? All the way back, I think, in like 2013, 2014 or something. And for years, that was the only thing I had really done on Kubrick. I think fast forward to like 2023, Jimmy Fallon Gong had talked about having me on Program to Chill to do a Kubrick thing, because he was a big fan of Dr. Strangelove too. So I decided to do a presentation on that. And that was the first time I'd really started to kind of toy around, like organizing all of my Kubrick research in forever. And I decided from there that I would probably go out and do a presentation on Kubrick for the Strange Realities Conference, and it just ended up becoming a massive thing working on that. So I ended up deciding to do a stream for that, I think around like November or something like that of 2023. I invited Chris and all the Secret Sun kids. They really dug it. So Chris invited me back to do Eyes Wide Shut. So for December 2023. So by this point in time, I compiled a ton of information, and I started working on the book formally around January, February of this year. But even then, it was like I had, I think, something like 30,000 words or something written from all the presentations when I spliced everything together, but there were no footnotes. And I ended up really reorganizing everything tremendously and wrote another, I think, 40,000 additional words or something. So I was kind of shocked. I mean, almost all of this came together in about 3 months or something like that. So I ended up doing a lot more additional writing on that than I had thought that I would do. But I mean, it did almost kind of practically write itself. And as you alluded to, it was also, I think, in a lot of ways, maybe the most personal thing I've written as well.
Yeah, indeed. And it's a great read. I read it in a couple of days, and it's a page turner. So, of course, I love the fact you have the footnotes at the bottom of the page. God, I hate endnotes. You got to go back and look, and then you got to flip back, and when the footnotes are at the bottom, it's like, aha, now I can, you know, look at his references and what else he's quoting. And yes, speaking of conferences, people, Stephen will be returning to the Astronosis 3 conference August 9th and 10th. As you may know, the theme is Sophia and Simulated Realities. And, you know, Stephen's going to give us a good presentation on simulated realities. We'll be having the exact topics and schedule in the next month. So it's going to be great. And again, Stephen, he's a blast to hang out with. And who knows, sometimes don't you do some tours whenever you're in a different
part? I was actually just going to bring that up. If anyone is interested, shoot me a message, because I do think that I am actually going to be going to House on the Rock around the time that I'm up there, either right before or right after the con. I was actually going to see if you wanted to come with me, Miguel, or any of the other speakers and so forth. So, yeah, definitely. Let me know. It'll be an all day thing, because I always insist when I take people to House on the Rock that you got to go to Taliesin East, Frank Lloyd Wright's studio first, because you really got to experience the dichotomy between those two places to get the full experience. But it's quite an adventure going to House on the Rock. So, yeah, if anybody's interested, definitely let me know. It's kind of another little bonus you get from coming up to this wonderful conference here. I usually find something weird in the area to go out to. And this time around, I wanted to open it up to people who are interested in attending with me. I'm still kind of bouncing back and forth on what I'm going to do my presentation on. I've been compiling a lot of information on a girl called Columbia for the last year and a half or so. Which I could do something really fun on, but I don't know if I'm going to be able to resist the whole notion of simulated realities. I got a lot of stuff that I've been doing with that. It kind of plays into this presentation I just did at Philosophical Research Society and the Fordian Society. So who knows, maybe I'll expand on some of this and some of the material that's going to be in my next book. But I'll definitely have something cool for everybody in addition to possibly some adventures at House on the Rock.
Cool. Yeah. Well, yeah, I might take you up on it. I know there's a lot of, a lot of burial mounds, maybe an hour south in Illinois, in Ohio, of course, Wisconsin is full of them. So yeah, there is something to do here beyond, of course, the mystical essence of the Theosophical Society and all that stuff. So yeah, please join us at Astronosis 3. Should be bigger than last time. The guest list is continued to growing, and we are going to have, it's going to be an amazing couple of days. And yeah, it's just the fraternity, the fellowship, the exchange of ideas, the fun times, and of course the information is just invaluable. And again, it's so important for us to connect on a personal level. Technology is great, but ultimately we're just pixels right now. It's an illusion, and it's great for exchanging information and starting friendships, but yeah, but making that egregore and connecting and interpersonal ways is just, it really uplifts your spirit and gives you a sense of freedom and just joy that, yeah.
No, it
we're
absolutely
not
so
alone, is. You know, we together we are really strong.
I can't emphasize that enough. It's just great to go out and have these experiences with everyone. This is, you know, it's a big part of what I've really been trying to do for the last couple of years or so. I was just in LA. I actually managed to throw my first rave at 41 years old in LA, remarkably, with Dimitri from Subliminal Jihad. But I mean, it was, you know, same thing. We wanted to try to create a forum where these different communities could come together in real life. Everybody could exchange ideals, have some fun, and we largely succeeded, I hope, in doing that. And you know, this is another aspect of that, a much bigger one, a better organized one on that note as well. So yeah, definitely give it a lot of thought, guys, if you're anywhere near the area. I can't emphasize how much fun this kind of stuff is. Be great for me, because I'm not going to be having to work the door at the same time as doing presentations and stuff like I did at the rave, but you know, so it goes.
Yeah. Steven the bouncer.
Awesome. Yeah, no, there was. I hope everybody appreciated that. You're showing up for the rave where, like, I'm going to be the speaker there, and I'm also the guy out there working the door, you know, taking your ticket too. So,
yeah, I worked as a bouncer when I was young. I worked everywhere in the service industry, dishwasher, I was a cook, a bartender, you name it, I've done it. A drug dealer.
That's why we get along so well, Miguel.
We were down on the trenches, yes. Awesome. Yeah. And for everybody in the chat, good to see everybody there. Please, if you have any questions or complaints against Graham or me, super chat them so that we can separate them. Please support this show. Like, subscribe, support in any way you can. Support Steven's Patreon on mine. You can do it for as low as $1 a month, because I know these are hard times. But yeah, let's keep this independent research going, because it's essential. It is civilization saving at this point. Let's get into your book, Steven. I think one of the first conspiracy or tropes that I wanted to tackle on Stanley Kubrick is people always assume that he was just this control freak. He took, you know, 80 shots because he had to have everything. And he was just this, very cold, machine-like, perfectionist, type A personality, whatever you want to call him. But as you write and argue, that's not reality, is it?
Well, certainly not. And one of the things that, as I had started to research Kubrick's career, some of these sort of eccentricities that are usually held up as evidence of his cruelty, like the 80 takes and that kind of thing, start to make a lot more sense. Because on the one hand, Kubrick used a lot of techniques that he borrowed from the surrealists. And I think that this included a variation on the cut-up method for when he was editing his films. He certainly used a variation on the exquisite corpse when he was writing the screenplays. Mm-hmm. So I think that this is one of the reasons why he did all these different takes, so that he would have them to draw from. But on top of that, I think it really just gets down to Kubrick really not knowing what he was looking for in terms of the performances from the actors in a given scene. So his approach in those circumstances was to film as many possible takes as you could to try to get a whole just stratosphere of reactions. And then when you go back to the editing process, you can essentially piece together the performance exactly as you want it. And this is sort of something, again, when you see a lot of actors going back and talking about working with Kubrick and how they'll say that the performance that ended up on stage or on screen was not what they thought that they were giving to the director. He ended up using a lot of takes that they thought that he would never use, this kind of thing. In a lot of cases, you end up with something on screen that is quite different from what the participants thought that they were going for when they filmed it. Kubrick would have definitely loved AI. I think that he actually would have almost liked to have totally foregone the process of working with the actors so he could just basically construct the performance from scratch, right up to the whim at the given moment when he was editing it, essentially.
yeah, like you said, not the surrealists, but also the Dadaists.
Yes.
Who were just, kind of just make it up as you go. And you talk about different examples. For example, there are continuity problems in The Shining. This does not show a maniac, control freak. And you talk about how he would write screenplays when he'd get together with his whatever partner, and they both sort of wrote things and just threw it together as a mashup. And it cracks me up because I'm just starting my David Bowie book. I don't know what I'm doing it with Elvis. There's a Voice. And who knows where it's going to take me, but Bowie had the same cut up style for much of his songwritings as well. Just cut it up, throw it in there, and hey, this is it. After Spiders of Mars, Ziggy Stardust, mm-hmm. that became it because he loved William Burroughs. But after he met William Burroughs, who also used the cut up method for his novels, he was like, I'm going to try this. So it's interesting that they were all sort of borrowing for each other of this rich tradition of surrealism and Dadaism, right?
Oh,
and
Jung, yeah.
Too, because they were all looking for the unconscious. Like, what's it going to bring out?
Well, another influence, I didn't really get into this as much in the book, but I think that it would certainly be clear with Kubrick's creative approach, and really probably Bowie's too, but jazz. Specifically jazz improvisation. You got to remember Kubrick was a jazz drummer from way back when he was in high school, and he continued to drum throughout his life, even though a lot of people don't realize this. But I definitely think too that the process of improvisation as it goes into jazz was another thing that heavily influenced his filmmaking. And that was just generally one of the more remarkable things that I came to appreciate about Kubrick and writing this book and a lot of the presentations that led up to it, was just how much improvisation was important to his filmmaking process. Because you always think of Kubrick as being this very cold, clinical, methodical filmmaker. He does you know, years worth of research and what have you, which he definitely did. But when it came time to actually filming the movies, he was always open to these sort of spur of the moment, almost random accidents that occur during filmmaking. And I think that that was a testament to just, you know, what a complete filmmaker he really was, because despite all of the preparation, he was not oblivious to a good idea when it just sort of randomly happened in front of him, you know?
Exactly. And yeah, and other characteristics which are great, like how even when he started out as a film director, he had to make money through what? Gambling, playing cards, chess. I mean, he was a high roller, wasn't he? A risk taker.
Yeah, no, definitely. Throughout the 50s, he largely supported himself as a professional gambler, as you said, both playing money for chess, going back to his time in New York. But I mean, later when he was in Hollywood, he basically supported himself in the late 50s as a gambler. And these are like really high stake games. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people here are kind of familiar with the scandals that came out, like, I guess it was maybe about a decade ago with Tobey Maguire and some of these kinds of games. But yeah, if you sort of see the recent movie Babylon, where ironically they have Tobey Maguire in there as this sort of gangster character, there's a lot of these allusions to these high stakes gambling games that were going on in Hollywood. These were the kind of games that Kubrick was in on, and that was partly how he was able to sustain himself during the leaner years of his career.
Yeah, pretty hardcore stuff. Also, I love, of course, there's a trope that he was, you know, afraid for his life, and he had a chauffeur, and he couldn't drive more than, what, 35 miles an hour or something like that. But then, as you write, he was kind of the opposite when he drove. He's like the most distractive driver, with a cigarette, looking around, almost getting into wrecks, you know. It kind of goes, he wasn't this careful, I might die kind of guy, was he?
Well, yeah, he had such a compelling amount of contrast with that, because like you're saying, he was an absolutely terrible driver. That's something that everybody who knew him agreed upon, even though they tried to push back against it. But there actually is quite a bit of compelling evidence that at different points he did not allow his drivers to go over 35. Emilio was different. Emilio D'Alessandro, who was his longtime driver and personal assistant, Emilio could drive the speed limits. Mm-hmm. Practically everybody else could not, though. So, but yeah, another thing too with Kubrick is he was a really heavy smoker. I think he had started smoking when he was like 12 years old, if I'm not mistaken. Continued to smoke pretty heavily, I think, all the way up through Barry Lyndon, and never really gave it up. He would always go back to smoking cigarettes during his films, even with Eyes Wide Shut. So this is sort of another thing with Kubrick. Would you think of him having this kind of pathological fear of death? Well, but this was a guy who was a really, really heavy smoker throughout his life. And again, it's, you know, it's not really talked about a lot, but he was actually a certified pilot. He did fly himself quite a bit in the 1950s prior to supposedly developing this all-consuming fear of flying. But this is one of the things I kind of argued in the book, is that at least some of these eccentricities might have been the result of a real fear that Kubrick had of being assassinated, which, as I again had started to research his life, I did not think that that was as outlandish as it seems, because there's a lot of documentation that Kubrick definitely thought that somebody would try to assassinate him at various points in his life. And I had always kind of wondered, was this just some of the, you know, kind of legendary paranoia? But the more I looked into this, there were some pretty serious threats made to his life at different points.
For sure. Yeah. Again, reminds me of, I think Bowie was, he used to smoke 3 packs of Gitane a day. Gitane is this French cigarette. If I have one, I smoke, if I have one Gitane, it's like hardcore. And, he was also, Bowie went through a period where he was afraid of flying. Elvis went through a period, again, both for 10 years, they would get on an
airplane. I mean, I think Bowie was also an extreme workaholic like Kubrick. I mean, that's like another thing. Kubrick only slept about 4 or 5 hours a day for about his entire life.
Really?
When he made his movies, I mean, he worked like 18 hours a day in a lot of cases. That's probably a big reason why he died at 70 years old, because the guy, he rode himself hard. He really, really did.
Yeah, for sure. Interesting, these artistic types. So now that we know that Kubrick wasn't this, again, methodical control freak, what the great conspiracy, and you address this in his book, is the moon landing. Tell us about what people get wrong about the moon landing, especially truthers and people in the occult.
Well, pretty much everything. I just like want to emphasize, like, and talk about this, I'm not saying that that the moon landing was not possibly faked. I'm not saying that it was faked, but I'm not saying that it was not necessarily faked either. So that's not really the point, I think, when you get into the question of whether Kubrick faked the moon landing. So this was obviously something that I had to do a lot of research on, because I knew people would be freaking out if I didn't try to really methodically address this topic. So this led to me basically trying to get back to the root causes, where this came from. And it turned out that Kubrick being linked to the moon landing and the moon landing being faked goes back to pretty much the beginning of this particular trope. So there was a book published by, I think it was Bill Kasing, called Did We Ever Go to the Moon, or something to that effect. It came out like in 75, 74, thereabouts. And this was essentially the very first book to seriously question whether or not the Apollo moon landings actually happened, if you will. And Kasing would continue to be one of the main guys in this particular strand of research for a lot of years. And in this book, he did bring up Kubrick, but it's important to emphasize that he never actually argued that Kubrick faked the moon landing. Kasing thought that Kubrick, that specifically 2001, had been used by NASA to develop the technology that would be necessary to fake the moon landing, but that Kubrick himself did not participate in this. And Kasing's evidence for this was basically that the budget of 2001 was doubled during production, and the litany of agencies that took part in it. And nominally, this is something that maybe seems somewhat suspicious, but not in the broader context of Kubrick's career. On the one hand, it was pretty common for his movies to go over budget. In fact, the uptick in budget in Barry Lyndon was far, far more substantial than what it was for 2001. I think Barry Lyndon, it went up like, wow. I think it was like, what, $4 million to start off with. It went up to like $12 million. So, I mean, it like tripled, whereas I think with 2001, it only doubled from $4 to $8 million or something. And then on top of that, it was really common for Kubrick to consult with a wide variety of agencies, with experts in any given field that he was making a movie on. And you can see this as well with like Dr. Strangelove, because everybody sort of points out like, well, he was consulting with NASA, and NASA had all these people going out here to work with him, which they did. But it was the same thing with Dr. Strangelove. He's consulting with all these national security experts. There's really lines in Dr. Strangelove that actually appear to have been taken directly from what would have been very classified National Security Council meetings at the time. A lot of interesting stuff with all that that nobody actually ever really seems to talk about very much. So Kubrick always used these sort of insiders as technical advisors. And depending upon the film, for instance, like with his Napoleon epic that he never got to make, I mean, he hired, I think, something like 30 Napoleonic scholars to work with him while he was working on the screenplay for this, and to help him devise the settings and the costumes and all this other kind of crap. He did the same thing for Barry Lyndon. For Full Metal Jacket, he brought in all kinds of experts to recreate, you know, Marine Corps basic training, all this other kind of stuff. So this was an obsession with him. He always wanted to get as close as possible to the realistic presentation of the topics that he was addressing. So he always, always consulted experts. And again, there's nothing unusual in Kubrick consulting with NASA for 2001 in the context of how he made movies. So what gets really interesting with the Kubrick conspiracies as it sort of unfolds is that the guy, or the person who really probably platformed Kasing, was Mae Brussel. She had him, they actually lived fairly close to each other in Carmel, I should point out, in California. And she had Kasing on several times on her show. And he actually hosted her radio broadcast, I think, on a couple of episodes when she was out as well. So for those of you unaware, Mae Brussel was legendary talk radio conspiracy theorist. She was one of the early titans. She's really one of the major liberal kind of conspiracy talk radio people, along with, I cannot remember the guy's name now off the top of my head. Well, anyway, he's not my favorite person in the world, so probably best. But anyway, Mae Brussel was a really, really big deal. But the thing about Mae that's especially interesting is that she, in turn, really was platformed and really given an audience from Paul Krasner, the longtime editor-in-chief of The Realist. Krasner had a lot of interesting connections. He was a bit of a Discordian. He knew Robert Anton Wilson. He knew the Yippies with Abby Hoffman and all these other people. Worked for Larry Flint. He knew Hugh Hefner and this whole Playboy crowd. And Krasner also did a lot of interesting parapolitical research in his own right. Some of his stuff on Manson and the Zodiac killings, for instance, is still some of the better research that you're going to find. Krasner was one of the first guys to like really seriously look at the angle of celebrity pornography and the Manson killings, for instance, which I've always felt was a really big aspect of that. So Krasner had a lot of sources. He was very aware of some of these sketchy scenes in L.A. at the time. And he worked with Mae Brussel on a lot of this stuff. He became enamored with her JFK assassination research. And that was what led him to help her get this radio show that became a real cult classic by the 1970s. So here was the thing with Kubrick. Kubrick loved The Realist. He was a subscriber of The Realist going all the way back to the late 1950s, right when Krasner first launched the publication. Okay. And he liked The Realist so much that it was an enormous influence on the humor of Dr. Strangelove. So much so that he actually wanted to hire Lenny Bruce at one point to write the screenplay for Dr. Strangelove. Bruce turned him down, and that was when they looked to Terry Southern, who was another guy very closely connected with The Realist, along with Lenny Bruce. Both of these guys contributed articles. They were both friends of Krasner and so forth. So Kubrick was very influenced by this whole milieu around The Realist. He was an avid reader of it, at least up until the time that he was making 2001 A Space Odyssey. And I have to think that there was a very, very strong possibility that Paul Krasner would have known Kubrick was a reader. Because again, when Kubrick subscribed in the late 50s, The Realist probably only had like 200 or 300 subscribers. It was very much a cult publication at this point in time. So this raises a lot of really interesting possibilities when you start thinking about how Mae Brussel, her radio show, is bringing Kasing on, and he's talking about Kubrick being involved in all of the NASA stuff and the fake moon landing. And I have really started to wonder if this was a case of Kubrick possibly trolling conspiracy theorists and also perpetuating his own legacy and mythology. Because Kubrick, he was a megalomaniac. You got to understand that. Kubrick wanted to be perceived as something other than a regular filmmaker. A Stanley Kubrick movie wasn't just a movie. It was an event. It was something you were supposed to tell your kids about what you were doing when you saw this Stanley Kubrick movie. So on the one hand, Kubrick putting out rumors that he helped fake the moon landing would have perpetuated this myth. It would have continued to elevate Stanley Kubrick above the level of being a normal director. And then on the other hand, as I just kind of alluded to, Kubrick had a pretty pucky sense of humor, very dry. I definitely think Kubrick would have gotten a real laugh out of this, having somebody like Mae Brussel coming on air and talking about how he was possibly involved in the moon landing hoax. And if Paul Krasner knew that Kubrick was a reader, I definitely think Krasner would have appreciated the humor to that as well, to put it mildly. And certainly, I don't think he would have been able to resist if Kubrick had possibly suggested to him that they should work to creating this myth.
And what about the concept of the NASA cameras that Kubrick used? You dispel that one too. That's been lingering for years.
Yeah, he didn't get the camera specifically from NASA for Barry Lyndon. They were actually at a company with Germany that NASA had sold to them secondhand, and it was one of his kind of gophers who went around the world looking for camera technology that found them. So yeah, it wasn't even something where like NASA just, I mean, the whole notion of that, I think, is just absolutely ridiculous in the first place. It's like Stanley Kubrick fakes the moon landing and NASA is willing to do something wonderful for him for doing all of this. And the thing that Kubrick asked them for is a camera that he can film by candlelight with. Like, seriously, like all the stuff he could ask for. No, I just want a candle that I can film by candlelight with. I don't even want the budget for my Napoleon movie. Fuck that. Just give me the camera.
Yeah, it is fascinating. Again, we've got Steven Snyder. We're discussing his book, The Minotaur, A Stanley Odyssey. Graham, do you have any questions or comment for Steven?
I was going to sit there and put my vote in for Barry Lyndon. That's probably been one of my favorite Kubrick films.
I'm telling you, Barry Lyndon's freaking rules, man. It is awesome.
The performance he got out of Ryan O'Neal there, it was just, it's amazing.
It really is.
Out of Ryan that are not in Ryan.
Well, again, that kind of goes into the whole thing of him constructing the performance through the edits. So, and yes, I very much think that that is a case where you could see Kubrick basically using editing to elicit something out of the actor that they may not have been capable of on their own accord, so to speak. It's kind of interesting. I'm glad you said that too, because I just had the debate with Jason Horsley over the quality of acting in Kubrick movies, which I certainly would argue that there's most of the performances are not naturalistic in the slightest, what Jason defined as bad acting, which, I mean, again, I think there's some legitimacy to that from a certain point of view, but I think you also kind of have to go into you got to take into account like what the intention was. In a lot of cases, Kubrick was not looking for a naturalistic performance from his actors. But in the case of Ryan O'Neal and Barry Lyndon, as you say, that really is a fantastic performance. And I think that that's really a great instance that shows that Kubrick could get a really, really strong performance out of an actor, and specifically an actor that's not even known for being phenomenally talented, to put it mildly, if he really wanted to. So I do think that that's a good point, because it does fly I think against the typical conventions in terms of how Kubrick approached acting in his films.
What about terrorizing Shelley Duvall? Or is that true?
Well, what's interesting about that is that, again, it kind of seems like this is something where Kubrick actually perpetuated that myth on his own accord, because a lot of that comes out of the documentary that his daughter, Vivian Kubrick, had made while they were filming The Shining. And there's a lot of those scenes in there that where Kubrick seems to be giving a pretty rough treatment. But my understanding is he actually had that edited in a way that made him seem much harsher with Duvall than the way that he actually treated her on the whole over the course of the production. So that's kind of like another one where, yeah, I mean, he was a little rough with her during the film, but it kind of seems like he deliberately exaggerated the amount of cruelty that he was engaged in that instance.
Exactly. Yeah. So much myth making. Yeah. And you brought up Jason Horsley. For those of you who don't know, he did come on the show to talk about his book, The Kubrickon, which is an excellent book. And yeah, as soon as I started opening yours, I was like, damn, The Kubrickon and Steven's book have to be like companion pieces, you know, the Boas or whatever pillars of the, of the Kubrick secret society. Because they're both great, and they do complement each other, and I love how you guys disagree. But what do you think of Jason's theory about how Kubrick was, his movies were more of an experiment to challenge consciousness, control consciousness, mine the human consciousness for data, and the climax would be the AI apotheosis or something like that. I think that's more or less one of his theories in the Cubicon, right?
Yeah, and I mean, it was definitely, my book was very much meant to be a companion piece to Jason's. It was a big part of what inspired me to write it in the first place. It was sort of ironic because some of the research that I had been doing for the Art trilogy, I had passed on to Jason. I was in the process of writing that that particular book, the first installment, which I came out with last year. And then Jason used that as sort of the part of the basis for his Kubrick book. And then I came back and read his Kubrick book, which was partly built on my research. And I was like, oh, well, I've got to do a response to this. So it's kind of interesting, the genesis of like these two works, you know, how much they really kind of bled out of like similar creation, if you will. But I definitely thought that Jason was really on to something like that. I mean, I thought one of his most striking theories was how Kubrick had almost designed his films as a reflective mirror, if you will, where what the viewer takes into the film is almost reflected back to them in terms of the symbolism and so forth. And I think the apex of this was really The Shining, which is also, I think, the movie where he really went, as you know, all in really with a lot of these surrealist techniques that we've talked about. But I told Jason this story as well, but when I was working on my Kubrick book, I mean, I must have watched The Shining like 20 times over like the span of 2 weeks. Ooh. And I would go into it, you know, just sort of like thinking, well, if I think about The Shining as being a metaphor for this, is it possible that it'll come off as being a metaphor for this? So kind of going in like, okay, The Shining, I'm going to try to see it this time as an allegory for the murders that happened to Taliesin East, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright's estate that I was just talking about there. Yeah. So I go back and watch and I was like, you know, it really does seem like an allegory. And then I'm thinking, no, I'm just insane. So like I would talk to a couple of my buddies, you know, who knew the Frank Lloyd Wright case pretty well with his mistress being killed there. And I was like, just kind of casually mention it. Like, didn't you guys think maybe Kubrick was getting into that with The Shining? And they would go back and watch and come to me and like, dude, it's amazing. You're absolutely right. This is an allegory. I can't believe I never saw the Frank Lloyd Wright connection before. But it's like, it's just so amazing. You can see it as just this, as a metaphor for the moon landing, for pedophilia, for genocide, for the Holocaust,
of the Native American Jews,
or just, it's such a,
it's almost like a psychic honey trap. You know, as you write, Playboy and Cielo Drive were real honey traps. This is a honey trap for our consciousness, our projection. I mean,
and that's like us, and that's where, you know, I know some people think Jason's theories on that were really outlandish, but I swear, especially in this case with The Shining, I really do feel like with the way he designed this movie, it almost does interact with your consciousness while you're viewing it. Which again is why I, you know, certainly would consider Kubrick to be the greatest director of all time, because I don't think anybody has ever made movies quite like this before. And it's like I was telling Jason, you know, I don't think I would actually rank one of Kubrick's movies in my top 20 all time favorite films, probably top 30, certainly top 40, top 50, but I don't think they would, a single one would turn up in the top 20. But like I just said, I could watch The Shining 20 times in the span of 2 weeks. And that's not even my favorite Kubrick film. I mean, it's probably not even my top three favorite Kubrick films. And I've found that this just seems to be the case with all of his movies. I can rewatch these films endlessly, always find something new to it, something really interesting thematically that I had never considered before. And in the case of The Shining, depending upon what you bring into it, when you go back and rewatch it, it's almost like an entirely new experience. And I just don't think that there's ever been a director that's managed to make movies that affected me as a viewer in this capacity. So in that sense, at least I, at least personally, can forgive Kubrick his egomania, because I do think that it was warranted. You know, nobody in my mind really, I mean, the closest I think you even get to this would be David Lynch. And even then, I just don't think that Lynch still was close to Kubrick's level in that regard.
Yeah, exactly. And what would you say is the one or two points where you and Jason disagree the most? Obviously, the big one is he does not like Stanley.
Yeah, Kubrick. I think that's...
He's very open about his hatred for his directing style in movies.
That's like the weird thing is, like, even though we like fundamentally disagree about Kubrick, we actually more or less agree like on everything else. But I mean, like I said, it's like, you know, we have like these I guess issues almost of semantics. It's like how Jason defines the acting. Like, he would say it's bad acting. I would say that it's unconventional acting. But it's like we both agree that there's something unnatural about the acting. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. It's kind of like, so that's where it's hard to say how much we really fundamentally disagree, I think, beyond the fact that I like Kubrick and Jason doesn't. But despite that, it seems like we can both watch his movies endlessly as well and still find new things in them every time. So I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. But I agree with Jason what, again, Kubrick was doing. I think he was a master Jungian and he had this power. I think he understood where technology was heading to. So he knew it'd be AI and the whole idea of social engineering and all that. I agree with you. I don't think it was part of the deep state, but you can expand on that if you want. But I do agree very much with one of your central thesis that you say Eyes Wide Shut and 2001 are like twin flames. And what they show is Kubrick is showing the world, or he's recreating a Neoplatonist theurgy ritual, or a Gnostic out of body fly the stars ritual. Isn't that what he's doing? I mean, he really was trying to show us this.
Yeah, that's very much my take on that. And I mean, I've said this is, I think, another point, Jason, I disagree on. I personally think 2001 is one of the most spiritual movies of the Cold War era, if not ever. That's not something that Jason would agree with. Let's just leave it at that. But yes, I definitely very much see 2001 as Kubrick attempting to really revive Gnosticism and Neoplatonism within the context of contemporary ufology. And I know, as you and Chris, I mean, all these other wonderful people in the synchromystical community have been talking about for years now, Gnosticism and Neoplatonism really were the OG ancient astronaut religions. I mean, this was something that I tried to get into a bit in the Kubrick book. But I mean, you know, you can go back to some of the old Neoplatonist theurgic texts, and they're having debates in there as to whether or not the gods are in physical ships when they descend from the stars and this kind of stuff. I mean, we've been having essentially the nuts and bolts argument, you know, I mean, for a couple of thousand years now. It's not even like a new debate, really. And this is something that I really, really have to believe that Kubrick was fundamentally aware of. And certainly when you look at the development of 2001, again, it's like everybody focuses on the hard research that they did, the stuff that they were doing with NASA to try to accurately recreate space travel as much as they possibly could. But on the flip side of the coin, Kubrick was also doing a tremendous amount of research into mythology at the same time. I mean, it's pretty widely acknowledged that The Hero with a Thousand Faces by Joseph Campbell, very much a Jungian when it comes to mythology, was a tremendous influence on 2001. But I definitely think that Kubrick was looking beyond simply Campbell in a broader context of mythology when he was making this film. And certainly he very much made the conscious decision about midway through production, around 66, 67, to really go all in making the film as a spiritual statement. And this was something, when Arthur C. Clarke originally saw 2001 in 68, he was actually rather horrified by this. I mean, he thought it was very pompous and pretentious, and, you know, because he thought that they were going to make the first really serious big budget science fiction movie that was going to be as scientifically accurate as all. And Clark, you know, when he actually saw it in person, he accurately interpreted it as being a religious allegory and not a true science fiction film, which is exactly what Kubrick ended up making with this. And I think, to put into context, just the mystical interpretation that Kubrick had of the UFO phenomenon, you have to consider that at the same time, in the early phases when he was developing the script with Clark, He was actually also looking into adapting the Shaver Mysteries, which kind of like blew my mind at first when I read that. But the more I thought about it, I mean, it made so much sense that Kubrick would have been into this. But he certainly was aware of this really just sort of woo-woo interpretation of this stuff that was very prevalent in some of these ufology circles at the same time. And I think that that ended up becoming a huge influence in his ultimate conception of the extraterrestrials. I mean, he famously had tried to develop special effects throughout production to depict them as physical beings. It failed. He ended up having to go back with what Carl Sagan had suggested in the first place, that you never see the extraterrestrials. But later on, he himself had suggested that what you are witnessing are beings essentially that have evolved beyond human consciousness, that have beyond physical being into essentially beings of pure consciousness, pure energy, who also are existing outside of time and space. Essentially, they've broken through linear time, if you will, almost the whole cycle of time. So I think that at the core of this is a very, very Gnostic cosmology that he's revealing here. And I just think that once you start to look at it in that context, it's unavoidable. I just don't know that you can really view it to 2001 any other way once you become aware of that.
And then with 2001, as you write, and we're going to Eyes Wide Shut, another thing you have is the Cult of Saturn, which of course is a secret society. It is an ancient mystical tradition, if you would. And basically, obviously, Eyes Wide Shut, both kind of are nodding to Saturn.
Yeah. I mean, I think with 2001, you're seeing a theurgic ritual in which the consciousness is trying to ascend through the gates of Saturn. And with Eyes Wide Shut, you're sort of seeing the reverse of this, where they're trying to draw down this Saturnine energy into these rituals that the cult is conducting at Somerton. And in this context, to me, Kubrick is very much reflecting on possible esoteric traditions that do exist amongst the American, or I should say maybe more accurately, the Western elite. And certainly there have been suggestions that Kubrick was hinting at some kind of Saturnine cult for a considerable amount of time. And this was something that in researching this, I was really trying to figure out if it was even possible if Kubrick would have been aware of something like this. I mean, obviously the use of Christmas and Eyes Wide Shut, I mean, clearly this seems to have come from James George Frazer's interpretation of Saturnalia in The Golden Bough, which was a work that Kubrick was absolutely obsessed with. That was extremely influential, not just on his work, but his entire worldview. But in reviewing this, I found that one of the major sources Kubrick had used for research for Eyes Wide Shut was an obscure book called Cult and the Occult. Was able to track a copy of it down. It was quite fascinating. It has several sections, some of which deal with more mundane, quote-unquote, esoteric knowledge, like tarot cards and astrology, you know, all this kind of stuff. But it has several really extensive sections on sex magic. And there actually is an entire section on it, on the Brotherhood of Saturn and their specific approach to sex magic, which is interesting because at the time, when this book came out in the 1980s, there was actually very little written in English about the Brotherhood of Saturn. Yeah. And for those of you unaware, this was sort of an offshoot of the OTO that was based out of Germany. They had a certain degree of notoriety in the Wagner Republic before the rise of the Nazi era. For you film fans out there, and this is another reason why I think that this would have been something that Kubrick would have zeroed in on, several members of the Brotherhood of Saturn were involved in the making of the classic Nosferatu. And in fact, there are some symbols from the Brotherhood of Saturn that were later used by the Brotherhood of Saturn in the film Nosferatu. So I definitely could see in this context that this would have been something that would have been absolutely fascinating to Kubrick because he was a fan of Nosferatu. So I was able to find the references in the book. It seemed to me, based on that and some of the other symbolism you see, i.e. a lot of the Saturnalia stuff, that Kubrick was very much trying to recreate in his interpretation what a modern cult of Saturn amongst the elite would have been like. And I think that this was something that he invested a considerable amount of time and probably resources in, because Eyes Wide Shut really sticks to the source material, Trauma Novel, actually very closely. The storyline follows it almost entirely spot on. And the one exception to this is the whole subplot involving Ziegler and the whole cult and what have you. I mean, all the scenes involving Ziegler, those are pretty much the only things that you don't see in the novella that Kubrick had deliberately added. So he very much consciously wanted to bring this parapolitical angle into the film. And he very much reconceived what was essentially kind of an elite swingers party, if you will, in Trauma Novel into this very ritualistic cult that ends up in the movie Eyes Wide Shut. So this is something that a lot of orthodox Kubrick scholars will bend over backwards to try to ignore. But to me, this is just something that is just so blatantly obvious. I mean, he deliberately went out of his way to add this entire subplot. He clearly did a tremendous amount of research into the ritualism that's displayed in this whole section, just into things that you see like in the background in terms of decorations and stuff in Ziegler's mansions. Because I've been to a fair amount of these elite residents now. You know, I mean, I've been to the Biltmore, I've been to Moir's, I just went to the Hearst Castle in California last month, which actually has a ton of those eight-pointed stars like you see all over.
Ishtar.
Yeah, but there's a lot of this kind of stuff. I mean, one point you see like Ziegler, there's the scene where they're at the pool room and there's like this fireplace in the background, and there's this weird like just sea serpent like looking monster thing like by the fireplace. And they actually have this stuff at like a ton of these elite mansions. I mean, they've got Hearst Castle, again, they got them at Biltmore, some of the other references like the Venetian pews. You see some of these like Greco-Roman tapestries at Somerton. All this stuff is in these mansions.
Wow.
So this is stuff that Kubrick, in my mind, really did a lot of research. And there's just a lot of these like little Easter eggs like that hidden throughout Eyes Wide Shut, with just the architecture alone that you're really not going to pick up on unless you've been to a lot of these residences and really, really paid a lot of attention to the stuff that they are furnished with. So it's something that I just don't think that you can ignore if you've really done the research on these topics.
Very much so. Yeah. And the orgy is basically a Saturn ritual for the audience. You're right. There is no literature. Stephen Flowers put out a book about 3 years ago on the Brotherhood of Saturn. So if you want all the stuff there, he has it. And yeah. And in 2001, isn't it, it happens in Jupiter, right? But he simply couldn't do Saturn.
Yeah. He wanted it to be in Saturn, yeah, but they couldn't come up with the special effects in time for when they had to finish the movie. But yes, it was originally supposed to be them going to Saturn, and that's what it's like in the book. But they ended up having to do Jupiter in the film for practical reasons.
Yeah, that makes sense. Graham, any super chats or question from you?
We have a comment on from Chester. His comment on the conspiracy world lore that Eyes Wide Shut was Kubrick's attempt to expose the elite practice of satanic sexual / sacrificial rituals, and that's what got him killed.
Well, again, as I tried to talk about this before, but he's not showing a satanic ritual in Eyes Wide Shut. It is a Saturnine ritual. The only thing that's really consistent with the satanic ritual are actually the backwards priest chants that you hear. And that was something that they changed on the soundtrack. In fact, originally they had a Hindu prayer, which is what appeared in the theatrical version. So, and again, this is something that Kubrick would have been well aware of. But again, okay, so this is something I've talked about before, but to clarify to people about this, I believe that there very much was an elite tradition of satanic cults. But I'm going to say this with a caveat.
Hey, shining crazy diamonds. Please subscribe for the second part of this interview. It certainly helps grow this Red Pill cafeteria. What's more, beyond getting the second half, you get content earlier and don't have to worry about flapdoodle commercials here or on other public platforms. So please become a Red Circle sub, Patreon, or AB Prime member for the full consciousness expanding gnosis. At Patreon, I have tiers as low as $1 or $3 a month. And at Red Circle, it's a clean $4.99 a month to stream all full shows. All subs include a dedicated private stream that works on most apps. Don't forget the Gnostic Tarot, which is selling well and optimizing spiritual growth based on the feedback I've gotten, and the Virtual Alexandria Academy. I can't do it without you. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being yourself, your true self, here in the desert of the real. Hello and goodbye, as always.
Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.